B-Pod Studios.
The great Tim Legler joins us on the Comcast Business Hotline. Timmy, I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Michael, buddy, good talking to you, man. How's everything?
Everything
good today, right?
Well, yeah, that was quite an exhibition last night, and I want you to make sense of Game 1 to Game 2.
I think what Game 1, basically, I think what happened, you had too many guys on that team just not play well, right? And I thought also the mentality of Ben Simmons was not what it needed to be. And what I saw out of him at the start of Game 2, for me, is how he should play every night. And what I mean by that is... I think there are times that Ben Simmons premeditates that he's going to make a pass or make a play. And he doesn't just read what's there in front of him when he uses his straight-ahead speed. Because for me, the best play for the Sixers, when he comes at you with a head of steam, whether that's open court or off a ball screen, whatever it may be, and he starts to turn the corner and he's underneath the foul line, the best play for that team is for him to then start thinking about being a scorer. And I thought that he set the tone very much in that regard at the start of the second game. So he played much better, obviously. J.J. Redick was a non-factor in Game 1. Tobias Harris, both of those guys played much better in Game 2. But I thought the tone was set at the start in a building that I know had a lot of anxiety in it. They needed a good start, and then they needed somewhere in that game some separation. They got that, obviously, at the start of the third quarter with the way that Embiid played. So for me, it may sound simplistic. Hey, guys played better, but I think that was a big part of it. But I also think the mentality of Ben Simmons in playing to his strengths and not being so predictable and attacking them and getting into the chest of Jared Allen and taking it strong to the rim and finishing plays, because that's the best play for the Sixers on that possession. I thought he did a much better job of reading that.
No question about it. They got the ball off the glass. He beat him up the floor and he attacked. And it's peculiar to watch him play, because there are games when he'll try the semi-attack and then they wall off with that defense. They bring a couple guys in front of him. They gate him. And he gives it off to a wing and then he disappears. What is the mindset of the guy? From game to game, I can't figure it out.
Yeah, I agree with you. He's one of the most mystifying players to watch play, because you know, the physical tools at 6'10", and the speed and the athletic ability and power, and he's actually got a soft touch, you know, on finishes. And there are games that he looks really so hesitant and so confused about what he's supposed to do because of how teams play him and the amount of room that they give him. Now, most of his strong take opportunities in Game 2 were in either flat-out open court situations or, you know, semi-early offense situations. You know, they weren't really coming once they got over half court, and then the ball moved a little bit and he ended up with it, and then he got to the rim. Like that, he still struggles with that because teams are so far off of him, and we've seen it get really to such an extreme. It looks ridiculous at times how far his defender is off of him in the half court, and that's when he looks like he's really confused. Like, what do I do? There's so much traffic in the lane. I've got 10 feet of space here. I don't know what to do because I can't really shoot a pull-up floater. I mean, he needs to get all the way where it's a layup or like a running hook shot. He's good with either hand. But when there's that many guys under the basket or in the restricted area and there's 10 feet of space before you get there, that's when he really looks most confused about what to do. And then you'll see him just run a dribble handoff, give the ball to Butler or Redick, and then he disappears for the rest of possession. I completely agree. That's why Game 2 was so important for him at the start, that he had so many opportunities downhill in the open floor where he could, there was nothing else on his mind other than beating those guys down the floor, even if Jared Allen was back there and he was going to attack him and force that guy to make a play on him at the rim. I love the mentality of being a scorer once he gets below the foul line, because I think too often he's already looking around, his head's on a swivel, like where do I make a play for somebody? And the best play for their team is for him to continue that possession by getting it all the way to the basket. I thought it just, when I watched him last night, I'm like, this is what Ben Simmons should look like every night. And he doesn't. And I know how frustrating it must be for Sixers fans as well.
Yeah, it is. And my kingdom for an 8-footer too, when they wall him off, because he's got that shot and he just won't take that thing.
And
it's just making me nuts. All right, so last night, what adjustments did they make on defense? First game, the Nets were really running simple high screens. There was no fight through, no help defense, and they were getting open shots galore with their quick guards. What did the Sixers do last night?
Well, Yeah, you're right. First of all, game one, I mean, D'Angelo Russell's eyes were as big as saucers because he's saying, I'm getting these ball screens at 27, 28 feet. There's no defender on the screener, and that was usually Embiid or Marjanovic, within 20 feet of the guy. So any guard in this league, you come off, and I've got one screen on my man, and now I've got like 10, 12 feet of space coming off of that. And I have everything at my disposal, pull up mid-range, shoot a three. You know, if you finally do come out, I just turn the corner on you and get all the way to the rim. He did whatever he wanted. He never at any point felt uncomfortable. I thought they did a better job of it. First half, not as much. I thought they did a better job in the second half, just trying to at least deny him the ball a little bit more so he wasn't coming off of dribble handoff unimpeded. And I thought Ben Simmons in particular did a better job of that. But truthfully what happened, Mike, if we're being honest, what happened was the Sixers blew the game open in the first 4 minutes of the third quarter, and their offense, Brooklyn's offense, sort of went out the window at the same time. And what they were doing that was so effective, they started going a little bit more for the home run ball and the kill shot and trying to get back in the game, and D'Angelo Russell was less of a factor as that thing went from, you know, 1 point to 20 in the blink of an eye, and then it was 25. And so he really got taken out of the game, I feel like, more by what the Sixers were doing to them on the other end of the floor, and the offensive game plan went out the window because D'Angelo Russell was still getting some space in the beginning of that game, and I still think that's a major concern for the Sixers because you're going to have Embiid or Marjanovic on the floor almost at all times, and they're just not comfortable being out there close to their man when they're setting a screen. And so those guards, Russell in particular, they still have too much space in my book, and I think Russell's going to have a big game three if they don't at least close that gap a little bit, or maybe at times maybe even play a little bit smaller.
Yeah, or fight through screens. That's another thing they can do. Like, they've got some.
Yeah, you can fight through a screen, but here's the problem. D'Angelo Russell is not a pure three-point shooter, but he's good enough, and he can get hot. So if you're going to chase him, let's say he's getting a ball screen, he's got the ball, and particularly when he's going to his left hand, and you're going to chase him, he's so good at coming off the screen and then doing something that they call now, it's called a snake dribble, where you come off and then actually you almost go completely around your screener where you're going back then into the direction that you just came from. It makes it so hard for Jimmy Butler or Ben Simmons or whoever's guarding him to chase him around the screen, and then they have to continue back looping almost all the way around the defender because they snake dribble back where they came from. Mm-hmm. It's too much ground to cover if you don't have somebody up there slowing down his progress. So it's easier said than done, just fight over a pick, because these guys are crafty with the ball, man, and they can really use that screen to create enough space and separation where now they're in a real comfortable place to shoot the basketball.
Talking to Tim Legler, ESPN NBA analyst. Tim, just one other strategical question, and that is T.J. McConnell out of the rotation last night. They were using Jimmy Butler and Tobias with the ball when they needed to. Is that the right move to keep him off the floor in a playoff series?
Look, you know, TJ brings a lot to them in terms of energy and spark, and we know what he brings, and but there are certain times when you just have to go with more talent. And I think that was a situation that they did last night. Tobias Harris looked like a completely different player. He was probably embarrassed by the way he played in the first game. He was much more aggressive. Jimmy Butler was fantastic in the first game, didn't have to do as much in game two, but I think both of those guys more than capable of getting their own offense against Brooklyn. And TJ, you know, as many things as he does that help you, you know, in this series, maybe you need more firepower. And so I was kind of happy to see that they went in a little bit of a different direction, and it clearly they broke it open. But I will say this too. It's amazing. Even Mike Scott is a good example of a guy that he looked a lot more comfortable when they were up 20 shooting the basketball.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't necessarily get fooled by, you know, how well some of those guys played once they could breathe a little bit, because I was joking last night on SportsCenter before the game. I said they were handing out sedatives for every fan that came in the building because I knew there was going to be a lot of tension in there last night. And there was, obviously. They couldn't put them away in the first half. That felt like it should have been a 15-point lead for the Sixers at halftime. It was weird. It's a one-point game. But, man, did they come out of the locker room and just end that thing quickly. And then everybody felt more comfortable shooting. Hopefully that carries over to Brooklyn. But I really think they've got a fight on their hands, and I'm not going to be shocked this thing gets shrunk to a three-game series when it's 2-2.
Hmm. All right, so I got to ask you the ultimate question here, because people are connecting the dots now. They were so impressive. Now they're connecting the dots to the second series potential. What's the ceiling for this team as you see them right now?
I said it last night. I tweeted this after the game. That's what it looks like when the most talented team in the Eastern Conference plays desperate. The question is, Mike, are they mature enough to harness that every night? You know, you can't pick and choose your spots when you're going to have to play better teams than Brooklyn. If they play desperate the way that they did last night, this is a team that can represent the East in the finals. There's no question in my mind. Now, if you ask me right now and forced me to lay money on it, I'd probably still put my money on the Bucks. I think they've been the best team in the East all year. I think that they don't have any holes. They got great role definition. They're incredibly well coached. I think they have a massive advantage in the coaching department. And so I would probably still lay my money on them. But the Sixers at their best, the way that they looked last night, in the second half of that game, that's a team that can get to the finals. The question is, are they mature enough and committed enough and focused enough to do that? Like every single night, particularly if they get past Brooklyn, they're going to play two better teams.
Well, that's why I'm going to ask you one at a time here, because you mentioned the Bucks, but Toronto is the first team. Are they capable of winning that series the way they are?
Yeah, they definitely are. Look, Toronto's a deep team, and they're a good team, obviously, and they got a star that plays both ends, and that's a team that's pretty complete as well. But that's a team also that's got some warts. I think they have a hard time now when they play bigger with Gasol. I think that's not a very good defensive team for them, and it manifested itself at the end of the game when Augustine gets a wide-open pull-up three because Gasol does not want to switch that, and they're better with Ibaka and Siakam at the 4-5 in defensive situations, but Marc Gasol's an all-star. So they've got to work through that. Kyle Lowry, who knows? Is he gonna go through these, you know, another one of these prolonged shooting slumps in the postseason? They might not survive that if that's the case against a team like Philadelphia. Philly at their best, when those guys are flowing the way they were last night, and Embiid is that physical and determined to not take the bait on what you want him to do, and he's just going to continue to drive that at you even when he has space, and take it into the paint and just overwhelm you physically. When he plays that physically and Simmons is that determined to break you down and finish as a scorer, there's no question in my mind that Philadelphia can beat the Toronto Raptors and the Milwaukee Bucks. But they've got to play at peak, man, close to 100%, a lot more often than we see them do it. That's where the concern comes in. We all know it. They're not a very consistent team with that type of effort. And they need to play like every night they're facing an elimination game. If they can somehow muster that, and it's easier said than done with younger players, but if they can muster that, then this is the most talented team in Eastern Conference. Their starting lineup is good enough to overcome anything they're going to see defensively.
All right. Even with this coach, right? We're good.
I do think they're at a disadvantage. And not just this series. I think that would be the case. I would say going forward, either of the next two series. I think that's definitely a disadvantage. I like to see more things mandated on this team offensively, Mike. I watch them sometimes and I just say, my God, if I could coach a team like this with this kind of talent and mandate through structure and sets and continuity and ball reversal and have a plan, not just like, hey, Ben, go down in the post when you feel like it. No, we have these three things as wrinkles in our offense. Well, we're going to run some stuff now to get him a back screen at the elbow and roll him into the post. This is a mandated set play because that's a really big part of our offense that we don't utilize. You know, how to get Joel Embiid the ball in easier spots. He doesn't always have to work so hard at 15 to 18 feet to beat his man. Same thing with J.J. Redick, who runs, you know, massively without the ball. A lot of it he gets on his own. But there are other very simple, quick-hitting things that you can run for J.J. Redick to get him something easier. So he doesn't have to run 12 miles every possession to get open. I just think there's a lot that is not forced upon these players offensively. Yeah. And it's more like, you know, you're kind of watching them play because you have so much talent. There's more there. And if you really want to max out who they are, potentially have a parade for this team, I just think that's got to happen, but it's not going to happen on the fly in the middle of a series. That's got to be put in training camp. That's got to be, you know, something that you've thought about in the offseason, and you come in and now you put these things in offensively. It's too late to do it now. You can add a thing from game to game, but overall, it's just not enough structure for me, or enough, you know, mandated ball movement reversal and player movement with a purpose There's not enough of that on this team. So I hear what you're saying, and I know there's a lot of anxiety in the city about that. Hopefully, these guys play hard enough. They've got enough talent to overcome that.
All right. Timmy, always a pleasure, man. Great stuff. We'll talk to you.
All right, Mike. Anytime, Mike.
Here he is, Tim Legler.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.